From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Health Secretary says anger over his controversial NHS reforms won't force him to resign. Andrew Lansley was heckled with shouts of scum as he left the Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh earlier. There are claims some within the government want the health service bill to be scrapped, but Mr Lansley's brushed off suggestions he should sacrifice himself to ensure its survival.
It's not about the bill as such, it's about what the bill enables the NHS to achieve in the future. And that's not about me, that's about us as a government.
In other news, the father of Damilola Taylor wants a public inquiry after one of his son's killers was recalled to prison for the second time in a year. Brothers Ricky and Danny Preddy were found guilty of the manslaughter of 10-year-old Damilola in 2006. Ricky Preddy is back in jail, having been released just 16 days ago. A high-ranking Greek official has resigned in protest over a proposed bailout deal for the country. The deputy foreign minister is the fourth cabinet member to resign over the EU demands. University and college lecturers are to be balloted for strike action over pension reforms. The University and College Union says members will be asked if they agree with the recommendation to refuse the government's offer and whether they'll back a walkout. Prince Harry says he's proud to be involved with the latest expedition for the forces charity Walking with the Wounded. This year, their aim is to send 5 wounded servicemen up Mount Everest. Last year, Prince Harry took part in the charity's expedition to the North Pole, but he says this is another level.
Mount Everest, a name to instill fears in the hearts of seasoned mountaineers, and not so for this new crop of lunatics, equipped with odd numbers of arms and legs, but staggering determination. Their courage defies words.
That's the latest. I'm Stuart Duggan.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station run almost entirely by volunteers and is here to give the community of Bristol a voice.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news, we ask a Libyan studying in Britain what's going on in his country now. With nearly 10,000 pro-Gaddafi prisoners and torture rife, has it all been worth it? And remember those Arab League observers in Syria last month? Well, why has their report been buried by the Western press, and what does it say? And despite being a wealthy conservative heartland, North Somerset infrastructure seems to be falling to bits. Failing to maintain roads, switching off streetlights at night, car crashes due to no white lines and overgrown road signs lost in the hedge, we turn the council inside out to find what makes them tick and prod a few of their weak spots. Somerset businessman Julian Parry's here with a report, plus we'll discuss fallout from the resignation of North Somerset MP Liam Fox, who's been holding hands once too often with a man who had no security clearance. That's Adam Werity. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. What's happened to the weather forecast? It's here somewhere. There it is. Lows tonight of -3 Celsius. That's well below freezing, and some light snow. This weekend, highs of 5 Celsius. Colder and sunnier on Saturday, warmer and cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 9 Celsius. Plenty of sunshine this week. Next weekend, 18th and 19th of February, that is, highs of 5 Celsius, sunny and dry. That's next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest. I'm joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Good afternoon.
Now, what about QE3? We've had QE1, we've had QE2. QE3 apparently is £20 billion. What does this actually mean?
Well, I think the significance of this is that the economy is softening largely as a result of the government's own policies of cuts.
What do you mean by softening?
Well, it's starting to contract rather than to grow. And as a result of that, the Bank of England has decided to print some imaginary money and give it to the banks in the hopes that they will then lend it on.
Okay, so why does this quantitative easing always go to the banks? Why isn't it spent direct into the economy or just given to the government?
You may well ask. Don't forget that at the same time, the government is carrying through savage spending cuts, which are taking all the demand out of the economy. So to make up for the demand they've taken out of the economy, they then print money to give to the banks in the hopes that they will then put it back in. And I think that the fact that the government of the Bank of England and others have decided this week to carry out a further quantitative easing basically is an indictment of central government policy. I mean, they shouldn't need to do that. They can simply reverse the cuts and then they wouldn't have to do that.
So, as you said, 20 billion, it's not 20 billion at all, it's 50 billion pounds. Aren't they just staving off the inevitable by doing this?
Well, they're just carrying on propping up the banks. Meanwhile, the policy the banks are insisting on, or the bondholders and the financial sector, is austerity. As a result of the austerity, the economy gets weaker, and then they demand money to bail themselves out because they're frightened that they're going to collapse unless they get some extra money. So the whole thing is being run to keep the private banking system on the road, and that is the root of the problem, basically.
Well, the Bank of England's in Threadneedle Street, and they said that UK exports were being affected by the shutdown in the rest of the global economy, and expressed concern about the indebtedness and competitiveness of some euro area countries. So it seems that in a way they're trying to sort of push the blame onto the eurozone. Is that fair?
No, it's not fair. I mean, in actual fact, of course, that is another reason why you shouldn't be carrying out spending cuts, because of the danger of the euro pulling down the British economy as it goes. But frankly, all of this is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. This deal in Greece is falling through as we speak. It's not going to stick because it can't stick. There's no more blood to be got out of the stone, and everybody serious knows that at some point Greece will default, and when it does, the banking system will collapse because of the collateralised debt obligations held in the derivatives market, which is at least 10 times bigger than the mainstream open market that people can see. They will all be triggered by a Greek default, and that will then lead to a crash in the banking system.
Well, never mind Greece for a minute. What about Britain? I mean, we are massively indebted as well in these situations. We've bailed out the banks that were going to collapse. If we weren't to have the QE, what would happen?
What would happen is that the banks would collapse quicker, and at some point they will collapse anyway. This is all just putting off the inevitable. I'm not really in favour of a deal over Greece or a deal or quantitative easing for Britain. The banks have had 4 years to get their act together, and so have governments. It's failed, and there is absolutely no point chucking money down that black hole anymore. We've got to accept that the banks are bust. We should have actually wound them up in an orderly fashion over the last 4 years. We haven't done so. Now there's going to be a crash. So we've got to adopt the crash position and recognise that that is what's going to happen.
Well, you sound to me like you're talking about a car crash. We have to brace yourself or whatever.
Yes.
And put your seatbelt on.
Yes, and when we've had the crash, we may then get some sensible discussion about what to do. There's no reason for us to have got ourselves backed into this corner. If we pursued a more rational policy from 4 years ago, the banks basically would have been dissolved in an orderly fashion. That's what should have happened. The two big-to-fail banks should have been liquidated, their existing management should have been sacked, and basically they should have been retaken over as a going concern by the government and run as a nationalised industry.
I mean, Martin,
that's not what's happened.
You seem to be talking about the banks more like loan sharks than ordinary, should we say, respectable institutions. Mm-hmm. And the only other people that I've heard talking about this kind of, you know, actually being really critical of the banks in this way, saying that actually they're just in it for what they can get out of it, is Max Keiser and Stacey Herbert on the Russia Today channel and on Press TV, which is now banned from Britain on the Sky platform. It was banned a few weeks ago, Press TV. But why is it, do you think, that there's only so few voices with this kind of really critical, extreme, basically saying that the banks are just acting in their own interest? They don't care about the rest of society.
Well, I mean, the banks, don't forget, have incredible political power. That's why they've been able to get as far as they have with the scams that they're pulling. And they are therefore able to control the mainstream media directly and indirectly. And don't forget, there's massive groupthink going on as well. Everybody thinks that somehow the existing private capitalist system with private banks at the centre of it is somehow a universal. And that we've got to have that, and there's no possible alternative. People who are inside that loop do not think in terms of it not being there. They can't imagine it. They're like fish. They live in water. They imagine that that's how it's got to continue. But of course, they're all going to get a shock because it's finished. And at some point, one way or another, in the very near future, everybody will be made very painfully aware of it.
So what do you think generally about the Keiser report? Is it a reasonable, you know, Max Keiser himself apparently used to be a stockbroker in New York. So.
Oh yes, he's a very brainy guy. I don't always agree with everything he says. He's and also his style of delivery is a bit shocking for those who have been brought up on the British BBC style of presentation. He's more of an entertainer in some ways in the way that he presents things. But once you've got over that, I mean, in the US, that kind of style of presentation is fairly common, and it's not so shocking. But at the same time, he's a very clever guy, and he's basically saying most of the right things.
Well, let's have a listen now to an excerpt from the Kaiser Report from Stacey Herbert and Max Kaiser, speaking about this QE3, the £50 billion of quantitative easing announced this week by the Bank of England.
Savers on the verge of retirement are facing the prospect of becoming permanently poorer as the Bank of England prepares to expand its program of quantitative easing, otherwise known as QE, by £50 billion this week. So a person about to retire will be hit by the bank's move because the value of annuities bought on retirement is based on returns from UK government bonds called gilts. These investments are bought by the bank during the easing process, thus driving down the yields.
The phrase permanently poorer stands out. All of the quantitative easing programs so far have failed in stoking growth, income, wage appreciation. They have made a few bankers extraordinarily wealthy. They would like to increase the rate of wealth transference from the many who will now become permanently poor to the very top 1% of the top 1%. I submit to you that this is neo-feudalism. This is feudalism. Had it not been for the Black Plague, we never would have had the middle class to begin with. If you recall your history, this is why lords paid the peasants a few extra bucks, because they had been wiped out in the plague. Well, now the lords want to go back to the 15th century or the 14th century and say, you know what? We're back in charge. Forget the middle class. It's all about indentured servitude and being permanently poor.
Max Kaiser there with Stacey Herbert being characteristically provocative. But Martin, to what extent is there truth to what he's saying about this whole thing of feudalism?
Well, feudalism was based on landed property, and clearly the shysters who are running the system are not based on landed property anymore.
They're based on
imaginary money.
Yeah.
But the idea that an oligarchy is in charge with a very definite program for its own self-benefit is fairly self-evident.
Well, we've got a new bunch of barons, haven't we? We've got a kind of we've got financial barons from the city, and we've also got the media barons like Mr. Murdoch.
Well, they're very closely linked, because of course controlling perception is very important if you want to carry out confidence tricks.
So are you actually saying that's partly what this is? I mean, because surely these people are well-intentioned. They're trying to sort the economy out. They're not confidence tricksters. Mervyn King. King Mervyn is not a confidence trickster.
Well, yeah, but he's only a minor player. He's like one of those kind of rather weak teachers on a wet Wednesday afternoon who's been brought in to deal with 4C, and he occasionally tells them, could you please stop shouting and sit at your desks? And the people in the financial services industry go, yeah, Mervyn, and carry on. That's what he does.
Anyway, moving on to Prime Minister's questions. And this week in the House of Commons on Wednesday, Ed Miliband had a bit of a confrontation with David Cameron over the National Health Service. Martin, can you just put this whole thing into context of just what the sort of changes we are contemplating with the Health and Social Care Bill?
Well, fundamentally, the idea is to open the National Health Service up to what they call any willing provider. In other words, having a planned national health system basically managed by the government is going to be undermined. The Conservative Liberal Democrat government are saying, well, it won't change the fact that it'll be free. It won't change the fact that the NHS will be the ultimate purchaser of all of these services. But the point is that the NHS was originally set up as a planned system, because in the 1940s, the people that set it up believed in a degree of planning. The idea that the market or a pseudo-market is the solution to every problem is the problem. In actual fact, some things are better off just planned from the top with tweaks from the bottom, but basically planned, and this will undermine that completely.
And isn't the trouble with a planned healthcare market is that it may be that, or unplanned in a way, it's because it's just a market, is that it's basically survival of the fittest or the richest.
Well, exactly, and of course people will be making money out of the system, and that's the whole point. I mean, we've got very strong vested interests. The US healthcare industry is circling like vultures over the NHS. But I think it's based, I mean, the Tory Conservative Home website this week has actually said this is a time bomb underneath the Tory party's election chances. If you remember, at the election, David Cameron said that there would be no top-down reorganisation of the NHS, which is precisely what they've clearly the proposals had been worked up beforehand, because they were produced as a white paper directly from Tory central office. So in other words, he was lying when he said that, and I think that people are going to be very, very angry about it in the long run.
Well, Obama in the United States has talked about a similar kind of introducing a similar kind of system over there, but it was met by an absolute firestorm against it. Why is that?
Well, because there's vested interests in everything. Milton Friedman pointed out a long time ago that once you develop vested interests in a setup, for example, a nationalised industry, say, for example, the banking industry, you could extend it to, say, something like the shipbuilding industry or the NHS, it then becomes a lobby for its own existence, which is the argument for super free markets, because once the government intervenes, they have to intervene more and more and more because they've created vested interests that demand more intervention. But the same is also true of private interests in the US. I mean, basically what Obama was proposing, that everybody should have compulsory private insurance, which the private companies were going, yeah, we'll go for that. And of course he opted out of having the public option, as it was called. And so Obama is trying to drag the US system, or was trying to drag the US system, towards the kind of thing that the Tories are proposing for this country. Meanwhile, the NHS as a concept, which is actually a planned, government-planned, from the top, if you like, system, is being undermined.
OK, so let's go to Prime Minister's questions this week. And so there was quite a lengthy exchange between the leader of the Labour Party, Ed Miliband, and the Prime Minister, David Cameron.
On the day the Prime Minister completed his NHS listening exercise, he said this: some of the people who work in the NHS were sceptical of our changes. Today, we are taking people with us. And it is in that spirit of unity that we want to continue. Why does he think he's failed?
Today, 95% of the country is covered by general practitioners who are not actually supporting our reforms, they're implementing our reforms. Yes.
Well, the Health Secretary is shouting from a sedentary position. It's nice to see him here. Today, Mr. Speaker.
Andrew Lansley laughed. The person next to him squeezed his arm in a comradely way.
Some distance away, I noticed. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister says he wants the voice of doctors to be heard in the NHS. Why doesn't he listen to them?
Well, it's always good to get a lecture on happy families from the Right Honourable Member. Look, I care passionately about our NHS, not least because of what it's done for my family and because of the amazing service that I've received. Now, I want to see that excellent service implemented for everyone. And that means two things. It means we've got to put more money into the NHS, and we are putting the money in, but it also means we've got to reform the NHS. They're not in favour of the money, they're not in favour of the reform, they're just a bunch of opportunists. Yeah.
This is a matter of trust in the Prime Minister. Can he honestly look people in the health service in the eye and say he's kept his promise of no more top-down reorganisation?
What we're doing is cutting the bureaucracy in the NHS. We are taking out £4.5 billion of bureaucracy that will be ploughed into patient care. Now, if you don't support the reform, you won't see that money go into operations, doctors, nurses, hospitals, healthcare assistants.
I'll tell him about our record on the NHS, Mr. Speaker. The shortest waiting times in NHS history. More doctors and nurses than ever before. The highest level of patient satisfaction ever in the health service. But everyone will have heard a Prime Minister unable to defend the promise he made, the promise of no more top-down reorganisations, a Prime Minister who has broken his word. Mr. Speaker, why won't he just give up and stop wasting billions and drop his bill?
If the record was so good, why were they thrown out at the last election? Right. He said the test was whether waiting times and waiting lists would come down. Let me now give him the figures. The figures are these: inpatient waiting times, down. Outpatient waiting times, down. the number of people waiting more than a year down to its lowest ever.
He knows in his heart of hearts this is a complete disaster, this bill. Yes. That's why his aides are saying the health secretary should be taken out and shot, because they know it's a disaster.
I've got to tell him, the career prospects for a right honourable friend are a lot better than his. Yeah. That's what this is about. This is not a campaign to save the NHS. This is a campaign to try and save his leadership.
That was David Cameron there ending that exchange between the Labour leader Ed Miliband and himself in the House of Commons. Martin, what we heard there was really David Cameron wasn't actually answering the questions. He was trying to say, this is your campaign to save your leadership, Ed.
Well, I mean, as I've said before on this programme, I find Prime Minister's questions extremely irritating. I mean, you could say it's quite amusing and interesting to listen to that kind of exchange, but often I think it leads to people in the country thinking that the politicians are kindergarten.
But it helps if people. The questions are actually answered, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and also, of course, both sides are trying to just score personal points and ad hominem attacks on the personality of the person opposite. And I think what I would like to see at Prime Minister's Question Time is one or the other, or perhaps both participants, to actually talk in an adult tone of voice in an adult way, and they might actually get more respect from the electorate if they did.
Well, we're also joined this evening by former Conservative Minister for Deregulation and Corporate Affairs. I think that was in the Major government, if I'm correct.
It was, quite right.
Between 1992 and 1994, that's Neil Hamilton. Neil, can you give us your take on Prime Minister's questions, first of all? Do you think that it is, as Martin said, a bit of a waste of time?
Well, it's certainly not an aspect of Parliament which sheds any light on anything. It produces a lot of heat, of course, and it's a form of public entertainment. But in terms of constitutional principle, and what does it actually contribute to the way in which the country is run and our understanding of what's going on in government and at Westminster, the answer is as near zero as you could possibly get. So it's actually been perverted from its original purpose when Prime Minister's Questions was founded about 50 years ago, and inevitably in a media age, there's no way of getting back to how things were before Parliament was broadcast. So I think it serves no purpose at all except to have this locking of horns between the political leaders so that we can judge them on their jousting abilities. But beyond that, it serves no purpose at all.
Also, your background, many people have known you from the Cash for Questions affair, and also you were minister for a while. What's your sort of political position now? You're no longer an MP, but are you part of any political party these days?
Well, I was
at all?
A Conservative MP for 14 years, but I've been going straight for quite a long time, and I've now joined UKIP, the UK Independence Party, because there's no point in being at Westminster any longer, really, when the bulk of the laws by which we are governed are actually made elsewhere.
But surely if you're going to fight Europe, you've got to do it from anywhere, whether it's Europe, in Brussels or Westminster.
Well, obviously UKIP is putting up candidates for Parliament as well as for the European Parliament elections. A political party has to succeed at all levels if it's to have a real influence. And, of course, Westminster does have some powers left for it, but a lot of the major issues in politics are out of the hands of Westminster politicians these days, and even things like, for example, closure of post offices or whether we should have the old-fashioned light bulbs or not. I mean, these are decisions that are now taken for us elsewhere in Brussels, not at Westminster, and so many of the things that we would like to do we can't do. I mean, for example, when Gordon Brown became Prime Minister in 1997, he wanted to get rid of the tax on domestic fuel, central heating fuel, but he was told he couldn't do it because VAT is now a tax that is controlled from Brussels. So until we recover our independence on so many bread and butter issues, Westminster is a bit of a sideshow.
But aren't you shutting the door after the horse has bolted there? Because if you're going to do this, it's already, those powers have already gone to Brussels. It's too late.
No, the door is already shut. What we want to do is reopen it. mind you, I was against going into the common market, as we called it then, right at the start. And I joined the Anti-Common Market League, can you believe it, in 1967. Yes, I am that old. And I opposed going in 1973 and throughout my years in Parliament. I voted against extensions of powers to remove them from Westminster and transfer them across to Brussels, and I wanted to repatriate them.
Now, before we talk about the this whole business with the National Health Service at the moment, yeah, and what many are calling the privatisation, let's just go back to sort of identify you historically, because you were involved in two quite important libel actions over the years. One was back in the 1980s, a panorama programme called Maggie's Militant Tendency. Neither of these, I mean, there was another one too more recently, the Cash for Questions one. Can you just tell us about the Maggie's Militant Tendency? Because, I mean, I can remember that one. That was a panorama programme.
Good, haven't you got old enough? Well, you must have been very precocious. At the age of 6 months, you were taking it all in.
I think it was, yes, I think it was actually 4 months. But but anyway, watching this panorama programme, it was during the time of the Labour militant scare, with the militant being part of a sort of a left-wing element within the Labour Party that was taking over cities like Liverpool, these kind of places. And there was a panorama programme showing the entire opposite, showing that the Conservative Party of the time, the 1980s, also had a, shall we say, rather than a far-left, a far-right tendency. And you were supposedly, anyway, part of that.
Yeah, that was the idea behind the programme. The trouble was it wasn't based on any facts. And yes, a militant tendency was a very powerful grassroots influence in the Labour Party in the late 70s and early 1980s. It was basically a Trotskyist-controlled movement.
But the head of the Young Conservatives...
They wanted, perfectly democratically, to take over the Labour Party, because the membership of the Labour Party had dwindled in big cities, and it didn't require a great many people to infiltrate them in order to control constituencies and select MPs, candidates who shared their view of the world. Now, nothing like that was actually going on inside the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party could never have been anything like as organised as was necessary to achieve such a result. Even if it were possible, it wouldn't have happened. But so this programme started out with what seemed to be, you know, quite a good idea. There must be a balance faction in the Conservative Party to balance the one in the Labour Party. The trouble was that it was a million miles from the truth.
Unfortunately, this never actually came to court, did it? Because
no,
the BBC caved in.
No, it did come to court, and it was only after I gave evidence and had been cross-examined by their leading counsel in court that the BBC did then cave in, because the absurdity of what they had been alleging against me, student pranks and so on, dressing up, you know, like Prince Harry in colourful period costume, shall we put it, was presented as a serious mark of political opinion. And
but surely,
that
I mean, it's
true.
You know, panorama, do you have the right to critique that kind of thing at the time, to put the whole thing in balance? Because, I mean, at the time, I can remember, there was Red Ken, there was a whole attack from the press on the whole sort of left, and surely the Conservative Party is entitled to have a right wing, just as the Labour Party to have a left wing.
Well, of course, I was accused of being a Nazi, which I don't think is right wing at all. It's not for nothing that the Nazi name came from the National Socialist German Workers' Party, so it was more of a socialist party than anything the Conservative Party resembles. You know, I don't believe in anything about control of the economy, for example, that Hitler and his followers believed in, to say nothing of their appalling policies on Jews and other racial minorities.
Okay, coming a bit more up to date though, with Cash for Questions with Mohammed Al-Fayed, what's your version of that one?
Well, I was accused by him of being paid to ask parliamentary questions on his behalf in the mid-1980s. And as everybody knows, he wanted to get a British passport and he was refused it. And he'd also been criticised by the Department of Trade and Industry, in which I later became a minister, for having made fraudulent representations to take over Harrods back in 1986. And I'd supported Fayed in those days against Tiny Rowland, who is his bitter business enemy, from whom he snatched Harrods under his very nose. And because Tiny Rowland was a bitter enemy of Margaret Thatcher, and of course Margaret Thatcher was a girlfriend of mine, so of course I wanted to defend her. This was an example of a political grudge match by Fayed, who made these allegations against me.
But again,
denied.
The case was dropped again, wasn't it?
Well, no, actually, I fought a libel action over it, but I lost the libel case. So that's one that I didn't win. But the Inland Revenue looked into all these allegations afterwards, because Taxman, of course, is only interested in one thing, getting the maximum amount in income tax. And so if Fayed had given me huge wads of cash, then the Revenue would have wanted their share of it. And so they looked over my tax affairs over 10 separate tax years in a three-year investigation by their top forensic accountants, and they came to the conclusion that there never had been any such cash payments at all, so I didn't have any tax to pay.
Okay, now up to date, National Health Service, do you think that this, what's going on at the moment with this Any Willing Provider business, looks to me a little bit like what happened, for example, with the Royal Mail, bringing in people to basically cherry pick parts that they want to, the, shall we say, high profit margin parts of the business, and that seems to be now happening in the health service too with this health and social care bill.
Well, I don't think it's quite the same, but we did try in the late 1980s something very similar to it in reforming the health service. We introduced competition in those days. We didn't even know what the difference in costs were between hospitals and the health service, being the largest single business in the country, if you like. It now consumes one-sixth of our entire national income and employs well over 1 million people. It's bigger than any organisation in the world other than the Chinese Red Army and the Indian Post Office, it's often said. And so it's vast and unwieldy, and it hides enormous inefficiencies, and something has to be done to change the system. I don't think that what is being proposed now is the right way to do it, and it's certainly been very badly handled politically, and it's now all blowing up in their face.
Martin, Neil's saying it's inefficient, the health service.
Well, I mean, I think the case for, as I said before Neil came, I think there is a case for planning, and conservatives of a different generation, I'm thinking of the 50s now, would have accepted that some industries do have to have a degree of planning involved with them. Competition isn't the answer to every problem that you face. So, for example, if we were in a major war as we were in World War II, you wouldn't want to have competition amongst the suppliers of weaponry and so on and so forth. So, you might at the margin. But, I mean, I think what the government is finding is that there's a great deal of residual goodwill towards the National Health Service concept in British society. And hopefully there will be some changes in the bill as a result of the representations that have been made by professional bodies who are affected.
So, Neil, do you think private profit should really dominate the whole of society, or are there parts that these private businesses shouldn't be allowed in?
Well, in a competitive system, you only make profits if you satisfy your customers. If you don't satisfy your customers, you make losses and you go out of business.
But not necessarily if you're monopolising. I mean, for example, we've had the first group around here running the bus service almost as a monopoly.
Well, transport systems are quite different from health provision, because you've got a single sort of grid network or something rather, as with, for
so
example,
you should privatise
the
health service before you privatise the buses.
I think there is good arguments for saying that, certainly. Perhaps not for buses, but certainly for rail and for other more capital-intensive forms of infrastructure which are difficult to duplicate on a competitive model. But, you know, the health service is a vast collection of different services that are provided to different people in different situations. And there's nothing wrong whatsoever in having private capital in the provision of health. After all, we do this routinely in dentistry, for example, and there's a significant private health sector in the country as well, which supplements the National Health Service. I'm not criticising the National Health Service as being endemically inefficient. All I'm saying is that any business of that size is bound to hide within it inefficiencies, simply because it's too big to be controlled centrally with any real understanding of what's going on deep down.
But isn't it better
to have... reporting systems are too complicated to make them work efficiently.
But isn't it better to have a system which delivers a service at cost, rather than have fat cat bosses taking money out of it and shareholders?
No, well, it's not better to deliver a service at cost if that cost is far too high, if it could be produced more cheaply in other ways. What matters is using the scarce resources that we've got most efficiently, so we get the best possible outcome from it. There's no shortage of ills to be treated, and we're constantly hearing of drugs that can't be prescribed because they're too expensive, or services that can't be provided because we haven't got the resources. What we want to do is make sure we get as much as possible for every pound that we spend, and the health service now does consume, as I said, 1/6 of all that the country produces. That is, £1 in out of every £6 that we earn in this country generally goes into health provision.
But surely that's just because health is important.
Yes, but it is important. Of course, it's important. But it's been a growing percentage of our income which is consumed in health over the years, and that's bound to increase with an ageing population. As an ageing person myself, I feel this, of course, very strongly. And so that the pressures on the health service to contain costs and be more efficient are going to be ever more important in the years ahead. We mustn't blind ourselves to alternative methods of provision.
OK, Martin, just briefly...
Can I just say one last thing? Yes, okay. I just said the important thing, of course, is that we maintain the principle of a service which is provided free to the recipient. Now, there are various ways in which you can finance that, but that's the fundamental principle which we all agree on.
Martin, this, do you think, is it a form of privatisation? What's going on with at the moment in the health and social care bill?
Well, I think if you look at the GNP per capita that's spent on the GNP of the United States, they spend something like 8 to 10%, I think it is, of their GNP on health, including private and public health. I'm not quite sure where you get the one sixth of our economy. Are we talking about public expenditure or the whole economy there for the size of the health service?
It's one sixth of government spending.
Government spending. Sorry, right. So if you compare GNP expenditure, the US system is, which is what we don't want, is extremely expensive and leads to millions of people having no health cover at all because they don't have insurance. And I presume that that's not what the government wants to do. Because if it is, they're going to find that the British people are not very happy
with
it.
But can't hospitals actually make more money from actually not curing you? If you're going to be ill for years, the hospitals make more money. Surely it's actually quite important.
That's what happens.
It's quite important to take that profit motive out, surely.
Well, as I said earlier on, there's the National Health Service contains within it a huge variety of services, and they can be financed in different ways. Obviously, the costs of chronic illness care and long-term geriatric care, for example, things like that, are a pit into which to throw money, and the costs have to be controlled in some ways. If you don't control them through the price mechanism, you control them through rationing. And who's to say which is the better of the two?
Sounds almost as deep as a banker's pocket. But anyway, on to our next story, and this is also from Prime Minister's Questions this week, where there was a rather worrying discussion about the falling numbers in our police forces.
Speaker, in March last year, the Prime Minister said there is no reason for there to be fewer frontline police officers. Mr. Speaker, can the Prime Minister now confirm that frontline officer numbers have been cut in 40 out of 43 police forces?
No, the proportion of officers on the front line is up, and I'm sure... And I'm sure he'll want to join me in congratulating Mayor Boris Johnson on his excellent record on crime in our capital. Total crime is down. Violent crime is down on buses and tubes. 11,000 knives and guns have been taken off our streets. And there are 1,000 more officers on the streets of London at the end of his term than at the beginning. That, together with his reminder of the rule of the dangers of tweeting, I think is a good start to the day.
Well, that was David Cameron answering a question there in Prime Minister's Questions about the numbers of police. Now, Martin, it seems we're going to have to get the Channel 4 fact-checkers onto this or something, because one person, what we've got here is we're completely opposite. Well, and the point being put there is that the police numbers are down now in 40 out of 43 forces. I think we just have to take that as read, although David Cameron is denying it. I mean, this is actually pretty worrying, isn't it? And I think it's fair to say that the Labour Party wouldn't have been able to get away with doing something like this.
Well, I think if you listen, as in the health service, if you listen to what chiefs of police are saying, like the chief of South Gloucestershire has been saying, that we can't manage on this settlement.
He's saying his service is on a cliff edge. The Gloucestershire Police is on a cliff edge.
As you will know from what I'm on this show every week, and people who listen to the show will know, I'm not in favour of cuts in public expenditure, full stop, for macroeconomic reasons. So I think we're actually getting ourselves into a big argument about where we're going to cut when we shouldn't actually be thinking in those terms anyway.
Well, where are you going to get the money from then?
Well, not through quantitative easing, which is what we were talking about earlier in the programme. Basically, Britain is in a slightly better position than the Eurozone at the moment. We could, in fact, keep the level of public expenditure up, which means we wouldn't have to quantitatively ease, hopefully.
Now, former Conservative Minister Neil Hamilton, what are your thoughts about police numbers? 40 out of 43 forces down in numbers already.
Well, I'm afraid we have to cut our coat according to the cloth, and I'm afraid there is no such thing as a free lunch in the long term. The government is still spending £5 for every £4 that it gets in taxation, and we've doubled the national debt in 4 years. This can't go on, and if we were to take the brakes off public expenditure any more than we have already, you would find that we'd lose credibility in financial markets and interest rates would go up.
But we're getting caught in a death spiral here, because the actual total quantity of debt is now up over £1 trillion.
Yes, that's certainly true. And there's no way out of this in the short term. The truth of the matter is there have been no cuts. There are cuts in prospect, but they haven't actually taken place. So the idea that the current squeeze on public spending is because the government has actually implemented cuts is completely false. Public spending is actually up. Public borrowing is up. The net deficit is up. And the amazing thing is that the financial markets so far don't seem to be too worried about this, but if the government were explicitly to take the brakes off public spending, they would soon wake up to the fact, and the cost of borrowing would be very much greater than they are. We're already paying on interest on the national debt a sum every year equivalent to the entire education budget in the country, for example, and that figure is rising year in and year out because the debt is rising, which has to be financed. So we've got to bite the bullet here, and we've got to take really tough decisions, but otherwise we'll end up as a basket case like Greece.
Well, talking about biting bullets, I mean, surely we've had two tranches now of sackings in the military. You know, certain regiments also now being earmarked for closure. Many of our military are simply not being, new people are not being recruited and trained up.
Yeah. Of course, there are arguments about what our priorities should be within public spending, and the government has ring-fenced the National Health Service and ring-fenced overseas aid. Quite why we should be providing £400 million a year in aid to India is a mystery to me, when they've just signed an £800 million contract with France to buy more jet fighters. So there are lots of places in which we can make cuts in public expenditure without harming the public interest.
But isn't this something which is a kind of conservative point of view? Because, I mean, back in the Thatcher era, we were seeing similar kinds of cuts. I mean, for example, in the energy industry, the coal industry, there was a massive strike and loads of our coal, you know, which we really needed at the time anyway for energy, those of our coal miners were sacked. Now what we're seeing is an even greater bunch of cuts. Surely the government just seems that needs to bite the bullet, as you were saying, but actually deal with the banks, deal with the financial system.
Well, it's not the banks' fault. The banks are merely operating within a financial framework set by the government and the Bank of England. So the idea that bankers are entirely to blame for the catastrophe which has taken place is a nonsense. The financial regulators fell down on the job, and the Bank of England, through its policy of quantitative easing, has stoked up enormous inflationary dangers for the future.
So what do you see?
And it hasn't worked. It hasn't actually reversed the tide of recession.
So what do you see as the way out? Just more cuts?
We've just got to restructure the economy, just as we did in the early 1980s. We were spending money on industries which had no future. We were creating a kind of industrial theme park, if you like. And what happened was, yes, we did close, you know, huge smokestack industries like coal and steel and shipbuilding, which had been the mainstay of whole communities and regions for generations. But in retrospect, that was entirely the right thing to do, because those industries had no future. They couldn't compete on the world stage, and we transferred the resources into areas which were more productive, and that's exactly what we've got to do again. And in the short term, it will be painful.
So you're talking about restructuring. Restructuring to what?
Well, I can't predict what businesses are going to be successful in 5 years' time.
Because, I mean, so much of our country now is covered with old factories that are sort of falling down, empty.
Well, I don't think that's correct, actually. I mean, I've seen in the course of the last 20 or 30 years the transformation of cities like Bristol, for example, in the centre, or Manchester or Liverpool even, where the industrial refuse of the Victorian age has sometimes been converted into very smart office and domestic accommodation, and whole areas of cities have been redeveloped into a form which, you know, can be used to create wealth in the 21st century. We can't preserve a form of industrial organisation which has outlived its usefulness, except at the price of beggaring ourselves.
Now we've got a situation in Bristol now with hundreds of offices empty across the city. Many of the offices out there right now, they've only got somebody on the ground floor, so that when pedestrians walk past, it looks like the building's being used.
Well, there's no escape from the painful reality of having to recover from decades of overspending. And if the government is spending £5 for every £4 that it earns, and British household debt also is amongst the highest in the world, private debt, that can't go on either. So when people stop spending, obviously the industries which were previously catering for them and their needs are going to feel the chill wind, and lots of them are going to go out of business. But that's inevitable. There are going to be bankruptcies, there's going to be a rise in unemployment. It cannot be avoided, whatever happens, because if you carry on printing money the way the Bank of England is going, you end up with a hyperinflation like in Zimbabwe or in Weimar Germany before the Second World War, and the whole economy grinds to a halt. So I'm afraid, as in every household, and if you're spending £1.50 for every pound that you earn, eventually you've got to stop. And when you do stop, you have to tighten your belt, sometimes for a protracted period.
OK, now, one of the things that I'm sure you won't like, because it's come from Europe, is this whole ban on smoking in pubs.
Yeah.
So Marina Morris has an item on smoking now.
Hello. The Welsh Assembly is to launch an advertising campaign to be called Fresh Start, seeking to persuade drivers in Wales not to smoke in a car when they're carrying children. First Minister Karen Jones claimed that smoking in cars poison children and that the Assembly would not shy away from legislation when the situation inconsiderate later in the parliamentary term. They claim 80% public support for a ban. In contrast, they say that British Medical Association support a total ban on smoking in cars. The best way to be non-smoker is never to start. Smoking is an addictive habit. Who wants to destroy their health, waste their money, smell like an ashtray, and stand around freezing outside a building to indulge in their habits? According to cancer research, about a fifth of UK adults. Addiction can explain why smokers proceed, but can science explain why people start, and could this include second-hand smoke? According to the Liverpool Longitudinal Smoking Study, which was founded by Roy Castle Lung Cancer Foundation, there has been little research into the effects of second-hand smoke. One of its main conclusions was that smoking trial at age 13 is more significantly associated with time spent in smoky places and also predicted by household smoking rules. Roy Castle was a jazz trumpeter and entertainer who died of lung cancer, having never directly smoked. He blamed his illness on passive smoking in the smoky clubs where he worked. A 1992 study of studies of the smoking-related behaviors and attitude of significant others, especially friends and parents, show that these are among the most consistent predictors of adolescent smoking. There is still debate how these effects work, but the balance of opinions appear to be that parents most affect behavior by creating pattern of normal behavior, and peers influence directly this shared smoking session. If 80% of the Welsh accept a fresh start, what do you Bristolians think about smoking in cars? The Welsh Assembly is considering introducing a smoking ban in private cars carrying children. Is making children breathe you smoke child abuse?
I think it is, because it's against their wills. They don't have a choice in the matter, really. They can't say no, they just accept what their parents do in front of them, really. They can't get out the car, it's sort of thrust upon them.
Well, children walk in the street and they're breathing in car fumes, aren't they? Is that child abuse as well? Is that going to constitute as child abuse, is it? A child walking past a car that's firing up its engine, diesel car as well?
I think child abuse is quite a strong word, but I think it's very selfish to smoke in cars. Growing up, my parents smoked in the car and it wasn't very pleasant. Yes or no? Yes, really. Because they don't have a choice. They're in the car. Because they're probably more likely to start smoking themselves, having been around parents who do.
No, it's not child abuse, because abuse has to be intentional. There's no intent there. So I don't consider it actually to be child abuse.
Yes, I would say. Probably is. Or certainly not good for them anyway, so...
Is this proposal an intrusion in private choices or a step towards a healthy lifestyle for children?
I think before the age of about 10, children don't really have their own sort of autonomy anyway. They can't make their own decision. It's not really an intrusion. They need to be led.
Unhealthy lifestyles for children is a bigger picture than just a parent smoking, isn't it? I feel it is anyway. As you said, there's a lot more air pollution about these days.
I would say healthier lifestyle for children. They've found out that it can cause asthma and just different childhood complaints, so...
Well, it's both, isn't it? It's the nanny state taking over and making choices for you. But there again, it is a step towards a healthier lifestyle for children, and they don't get to choose themselves, so I can see good and bad in that.
I think it is a bit of intrusion, but then maybe worthwhile intrusion. To sort of try and protect children, then yeah, it's worth it, I would say.
I guess people who do smoke probably find that they have enough sort of political intervention in their everyday lives. There's enough sort of legislation at the minute sort of telling them what they can and can't do. They might find it a bit of an intrusion saying that you can't smoke in your car and what have you. I guess how you prove that? Would you have to catch them smoking while they've got children in the car, and who would regulate that? Because current legislation, such as people not being able to, they shouldn't be using their mobile phone, doesn't really get sort of clamped down on. So how would they sort of look to, you know, who would take responsibility for implementing that as well?
Is the key to behavioural change education or punishment? And should we protect children's health from their parents?
I'd say education, because it's about sort of forging behaviours when people are young and sort of teaching them the right way to try and make better decisions later on in life. If you punish people, it needs to be backed up, at least by education anyway. Parents do need to be educate themselves about how to protect their own children, but I think children are quite defenceless and they need sort of a lot of protection, really.
The health of children should be protected, but it's not only a parent's responsibility, it's society's responsibility. I think a lot of pressure is put on parents today, and perhaps we should be looking at the bigger picture instead of looking for ways to blame parents. I think parents get a lot of blame these days.
Oh, education, definitely. Well, when people realise consequences of what they do, then it might change the way they do live their lives.
Well, it's both, isn't it? It's the nanny state taking over and making choices for you. But there again, it is a step towards a healthier lifestyle for children, and they don't get to choose themselves, so I can see good and bad in that. There's always going to be bad parents out there, I'm afraid. You can protect children up to a certain extent, and certainly many steps have been made over the last few years, but you're never going to, unfortunately, protect all children in the world.
Punishment's going to make people react badly to it, whereas I think if you're actually really trying to educate people and make them do the right thing, then I think they're more likely to listen. I think we should be taking every step to make sure that people are aware of the consequences of what they're doing when they've got children to look after. So
that was Marina out on the streets of Bristol asking you what you think about this Welsh Assembly idea of banning smoking in cars. Now, former Conservative Minister Neil Hamilton, what do you think about this? Is this does it make sense? Surely it's not very good for kids if they're sitting in a smoky car, is it?
I think the whole smoking ban business is outrageous, an appalling infringement upon people's liberty.
Liberty of the child?
As regards smoking in cars, first, let's get this clear. There's absolutely no credible evidence whatsoever that passive smoking, as it's called, or secondhand smoke, does any damage to any person who breathes it in. Sir Richard Doll, who was the man who discovered the link between smoking and cancer, appeared on that well-known medical programme, Desert Island Discs, when Sue Lawley was doing it many years ago. And she asked him about this, and he said it was one thing which caused him no sleepless nights whatsoever. He wasn't worried about it. The risk was so infinitesimally small. And this is just part of the ongoing war against the smoker. I don't smoke myself, so I have no personal interest in this at all. And I do appreciate that secondhand smoke may not be pleasant, but that's a different matter altogether from saying that it injures the health of people who breathe it in. Of course, if you like a smoking beagle and inhale it in those sort of quantities, possibly it could do some damage to
you. So what you're saying is that the Welsh Assembly is just as bad as Brussels?
Oh, very much so, I should think. They're two of a kind. They deserve each other, in my opinion. And I grew up in Wales, so I know a bit about it. And the sort of people who are in the Welsh Assembly are exactly the kind of bossy, interfering termagants that inhabit the corridors of Brussels as well. So, of course, I'm opposed to this, and anybody who believes in the freedom of the individual should take the same view. After all, where's this end? Are we going to ban McDonald's next? Ban fish and chip shops? Are we going to ban any form of sport which is dangerous or which could cause harm? We're going to ban do-it-yourself. I fell off a ladder repairing a window at home just before Christmas. Very, very dangerous, that. So, clearly, one should be licensed to go up a ladder even in your own household situation.
Martin, what was your thoughts on this Welsh Assembly proposal?
Well, I think, you know, just picking up on what Neil said there, I mean, why are we banning MDMA and cannabis, for example? I mean, I think that they shouldn't be banned either, and there's a strong case.
I agree with you.
I thought you might, and I think it's interesting, isn't it, that we can agree on lots of different things despite our differences on other matters.
Yeah. But why is that? I mean, you know, these are dangerous drugs, for goodness sake.
Well, yes, but as Neil points out, we don't ban dangerous sports like mountain climbing. We have a mountain rescue team, and I'm afraid that life is a risk.
Talking about the health service earlier, right? And all these things are actually bad for your health. Smoking is bad for your health.
Yes, but you can't. But by banning them, all you, for example, if we were to ban smoking, literally ban it, we would have an enormous problem of an illegal market which would grow up immediately. We've already got an illegal market in cigarettes and so on, which have not been a tax hasn't been paid on them, and it's even if you have that illegal market, it's very difficult.
So how do you draw the line on what you ban and what you don't ban?
I think what you do is you have a discussion about it. If you look at Australia, they've now got the lowest smoking level in the world. And it's partly because it's just a social change that's taken place in Australia. It's probably to do with the weather they have there. They live an outdoor lifestyle. They all love
being fit
and sporty.
It's just seen as not cool.
And they reckon that in Australia, within the next 20 to 25 years, if they carry on, they will have no smokers at all. Now, they've done that by basically nagging each other. And I'm afraid this kind of discussion in the Welsh Assembly, they're not actually going to bring forward legislation. It's a bit of nagging. And I'm afraid a bit of nagging is what it takes to change people's attitudes.
I mean, nicotine
isn't it?
Is a drug, Neil. Yeah. Where do you draw the line? Which drugs do you ban and which drugs don't you ban?
Well, the one thing I think we can certainly agree on is that the policy of controlling drugs through criminalisation has completely and comprehensively failed. In fact, what we've done is to create a whole raft of problems which are of far greater significance to the wider public than the problems that drugs cause to their users. And we've created a whole criminal fraternity in the same way as prohibition against alcohol in the 1920s did in the United States. And after all, I mean, there is a tacit acceptance of drugs inside every single prison in the country because the prison governors and prison officers know that there is uncontrolled traffic in drugs in prison to all intents and purposes, and they allow it to go on because it keeps prisoners more docile. If they tried to really to stamp it out, then prisons would become absolute mayhem. So the authorities are hypocritical in this respect as well, in my opinion.
Okay, our final story today. The court has banned prayers at formal council meetings. Practice of saying prayers at Biddeford Town Council is understood to date back to the days of Queen Elizabeth I. Councils recently twice voted in support of continuing with the prayers as part of their agenda. Individual councillors were free to not take part in the prayers if they wished, and the register of attendance was not taken until after the prayers had finished. Former Conservative Minister Neil Hamilton, what's your thoughts on this move
today?
Well,
I'm entirely opposed to making the prayers illegal. Parliament starts every day by prayers being said in the chamber, both the Commons and the Lords, is the one thing which is not televised in Parliament, and you were free to attend or not to attend. And
so you can do it in Parliament, but you can't do it in your local authority.
Absolutely, and I think this is absurd. It's part of the cultural background of this country, even though most people are not religious or practicing Christians to any extent. But I think this is entirely harmless, having prayers at the beginning of a council meeting, and they're wholly benign, asking God to bless the proceedings and guide the councillors to the right decisions. What could be wrong with that? God comes in many forms according to your form of belief, and nobody's trying to force a particular religion on anybody, although we do have an established church established by law, the Church of England, and so long as there's an establishment, I can't see how in principle you can object to prayers at a council meeting.
I mean, I used to be on the Cultural Development Partnership before I was elbowed out by the business community, John Savage particularly, and at the beginning of the lunches, where we ever had a lunch there, Louis Sherwood, the old chairman of HTV, always used to open with prayer. Martin, just very briefly, what's your thought about this ruling today?
Well, I think, as Neil points out, while you've got an established church, the Church of England, you've got the church has a role with, there's bishops in the House of Lords and so on. Now, you could make a case that we ought to have a written constitution like the German constitution, for example, where all of this is, or the American constitution, where all of this is put into some kind of order. But at the moment, it's a mess, and it's going to carry on being a mess.
Okay, that's Sky News at 6 time now. Thanks to this week's guest, former Conservative Minister Neil Hamilton. More after the news.
UK, BCFM News from the Sky.